The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next generation has therefore saved this generation once again, because what comes to them intuitively with technology is something that does not come intuitively to me, so thank you. I'm sorry to be starting a minute late. My name is Leslie Collins. It's my joy and delight to have so many people in this room talking about including students with disabilities in the classical and Christian classroom. What a blessing it is for us to have the privilege to serve families in this way. Let me pray. Father, we thank you that you have made us in your image, broken and wounded and needy, and yet part of your body. Father, we ask that you would help us to understand what we know not, to be able to persuade others, to be able to equip and strengthen and encourage. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. The outline for today is on page 70 in your notebook, and it is a very loaded outline intentionally. I apologize that there is not a lot of space for you to take notes. My experience has been that this is a very loaded topic, and it's a topic that people are constantly asking questions about, and people are constantly needing more information. So my approach in giving you that very, very loaded outline is that you would have a lot of information there that perhaps generate a lot of questions. I guarantee you that there's someone in your network of people who is an expert or has experience and can answer some of these questions. My desire is that you would have information with which to go and get more questions answered, because I'm certainly not going to be able to do that in an hour. My desire is to be able to communicate several things and be able to leave some things on the outline so that you can take those home. So the section in your outline that talks about modifications based on student needs, that section on page 70A and has many different areas of processing. I'm really not going to touch on that unless you bring those things up and you need clarification on that, because it would take me, that's a good semester worth of instruction right there. So I'm just going to leave that on the page there so it can provide information for you to get more questions answered. But what I really want to talk about is the reason that inclusion is important and why inclusion versus self-contained. So I want to know my audience a little bit. How many of you need convincing? And please be completely honest. How many of you need me to convince you that this is a worthwhile thing to do? Okay. And how many of you have students in your school who you believe have disabilities that are not identified and everyone's afraid to identify them? Oh, yeah. That's the audience I thought I was talking to. How many of you are not sure that it's possible to actually provide support for students with disabilities in a classical and Christian environment? Okay. All right. And how many of you have experience with special education and are trained in modification and developmental challenges? All right. Well, that's very helpful. Okay. Well, what I would like to do is share with you a little bit of my experience and what I have learned. I actually did this talk about 10 years ago. And at that time, the audience was still very much, I'm not so sure, I think we need convincing, is this even the right thing to be doing? And it's moved a lot in the last 10 years. The audience is much more, I know we have this problem. And I have another question for you. How many of you have families in your school who have one child or more who have, you think, a disability, and you're not sure how long they're going to last at your school, and that concerns you? We have a number of those students at our school. We're actually able to serve them, and I'm excited about that. My background in special education began in 1991, well, actually longer before that when I was in college, but as a teacher, I started it way back in the 90s. And after 4 years of working in the public school system in Maryland, I was frustrated You see, I wanted to be a light. I wanted to be a blessing. I wanted to be a missionary. And I am thankful that I was able to bring a number of the families that I worked with to my church. I was able to incorporate them into the Sunday school program and the student support program that we had going on in our church. I was grateful to see them come to know the Lord. I was grateful to see those who knew the Lord be blessed. Sometimes I went into their church and said, here's how you can include that child rather than have them off in the nursery when they're 8 years old. Those are some of the things that I was excited about. But what happened is time and time again, ideology and understanding who this person was I was looking at and who these people are in the classroom never seemed to agree. And I was, and unwittingly, I was hampered by the politics. I was hampered by that ideology and the way it worked itself out in the classroom. And lo and behold, in 1995, there was a school that was getting started called Rockbridge Academy, and they asked me to be part of what they were doing to lead the school. And part of our vision as a school back in 1995 was we believed that it was possible and good to have students with disabilities in our classroom. And how could we do that without compromising either student? That was actually part of the founding of that school. And I'm very grateful in the way that God has used that school to help so many. So I'd like to talk about the mandates. First of all, we all agree that we are called by God to train up our children in the nurture of the Lord. We know that. There's not a single one of us, probably in this room, who believes that somebody else should be training up the children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, that we as parents are their primary educators, and it is our duty. And so that basic idea of training your children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, helping them to understand that there is not one inch of this universe of which our Lord Jesus Christ is not sovereign over all, that is fundamental to the way in which they attack every aspect of learning. And they approach learning with a winsome way because they believe that God has ordained that. That is biblical. So I would like to know then, which one of our children should we render unto Caesar? We believe, I have in the outline, it says familial. I'm just trying to not let you know that I'm Reformed, but I am, and so it's okay for me to say the word covenantal. After I made the outline and then made the slides, I just got my courage back up again. But I believe that we are called to educate our children and our children's children and our children's 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 children. We are called to do this. I am not rendering any of them up unto Caesar. I am not. So many classical Christian schools will call me and say, we don't know what to do. So we just went to the people who seemed to know what to do. And so the public school was helping us out. I can tell you, I've worked with some of those folks, and some of them really know what they're doing. And many of them don't know more than you do. And the ideology is eventually going to get in the way. I'm not rendering any of them unto Caesar, certainly not the least of these, certainly not the ones who are weak and need our support. And I believe that it's classical. Raise your hand if you believe that a classical Christian classroom is by nature orderly. It's orderly. Okay. Raise your hand if you believe that a classical and Christian classroom is by nature developmental. We believe in a developmental process. Okay. Raise your hand if you believe that a classical and Christian classroom is one in which the teacher is large and in charge. Some of you aren't so sure about that one. Okay. I mean in a loving way. And so tell me if you believe that a classical, raise your hand if you believe that a classical and Christian classroom has the child's best interest at heart and is seeking to help unfold what God has put in them. Well, that is also a special ed classroom. And did you know that many of the publishers and the writers of materials that so many classical Christian classrooms use are special educators? Brenda Shirley and all of her genius in the Shirley Method designed that because she was a hardcore public school, old school special ed teacher. And why does it work? Because she understood the way the brain worked. She understood the way kids needed to learn. And she put that into a methodology that, lo and behold, coordinates with our classical Christian methodology. How many of you use the Shirley Method? Yeah, most of us do. And it works. She had no idea. I know. I talked to her about it. She had no idea who Dorothy Sayers was or what this whole deal of classical was, and that was back in the 90s. I'm sure she knows now. My point is that so many of the things that we do, we had no idea are actually using the methodology of special education, because guess what's so special about special ed? Not a whole lot. What we know is mastery. We know how to teach to mastery, and we know how to assess when mastery is not happening and when you are convincing yourself that it's happening. That's what's special about special ed. We teach to mastery, and we evaluate and ask the hard questions. So if you have a passion to teach to mastery, and if you have a passion to understand what every single child in your classroom is doing, then you are just as equipped as many of the special educators that you might think have more skills than you. So I would say that inclusion in the classical Christian classroom is mandated biblically, because we are called to train up our children, not some of them, all of them, that we are called to bring them into a community, and that we are called to teach them in the classical way. I think it goes with the grain. It makes sense. It's the most natural thing to do. Now, why is it that I would say inclusion over a self-contained classroom? Well, self-contained classrooms can be very helpful, and I don't want to dismiss that. But I think when you are talking about a community in your school, I think probably what sets classical Christian schools apart from other schools is the community. It's the fact that you have older students loving on and caring for younger students, that you have faculty who interact with them. Am I right? And so when you render these students who have disabilities to this special classroom, you're saying you're really not part of this larger community. And the research shows that kids with disabilities are truly best served when they have one-on-one instruction in the environment with their peers. Classical Christian classrooms are by nature a very language-rich environment. And students with disabilities typically by nature struggle with language development. So put them in a language-rich environment where they are being called up, where they're being encouraged. Do you know what kids with disabilities need more than anything? They need to know that they're loved. By the way, all kids need to know that they're loved. They need to know that you know them, that they are fully known and fully loved, that you see all of their weaknesses and you're not scared, that you're right there with them. Every kid needs that. And so students with disabilities tend to do better, research says, and basic common sense says. They tend to do better when they're part of a whole. So I'd like to define inclusion a little bit more. It's not mainstreaming or dumping. Mainstreaming is, you are doing just fine. We no longer need to provide you services, and we're going to send you out with the big fish. And most people say, I'm pretty sure that that's money that is the incentive of this decision. I'm pretty sure that it's not the kids' best interest at heart. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's time for them to swim on their own. But sometimes, back in the mind of the teacher, of an excellent teacher, they're wondering, is that the best thing to do? It's not mainstreaming and it's not dumping. We don't throw kids that we know have a challenge into a classroom and say, go ahead, swim, little fishy, you'll be just fine. That's actually not productive. And it's not dumbing down or compromising. We don't take the rest of the class down and we don't say, well, you know, we really have this expectation for everyone, but for you, we'll, you know, fudge a little bit, it'll be okay. We don't do that. We're not dumbing down the whole classroom, and we're not taking our expectations for that student down and saying, well, for you, we're just going to make it this way. I once met a teacher I was interviewing, and the point in which I knew that this was not going to be a workable relationship was when I asked, tell me about your homeschooling experience. And her answer was, well, my children have some challenges, and so what I did was when I homeschooled them, I just took away the parts of the lesson that were challenging for them, and then I found that they were successful. And I thought, okay, thank you. Glad to know you. God bless you. Find a school that works for you. I didn't say that. I think that there are different kinds of special educators. There are special educators for whom they want to just have this sweet little environment in which all the children feel happy all the time, and we want to make sure they know that they're loved, and we just want to make sure that my classroom is the safe space, and I'm going to be their advocate, and everybody's going to be my friend, and we're all going to be nice to each other. And then there are the special educators that say, no, that is not working, that is not productive. You're going to get in there, you are going to do well, and I've got my hand on your shoulders and my foot on your behind, and I am pushing you out of this nest because I am not your safe place. You need to find safety by being a strong and sturdy kid. I'm that special educator. I'm not the sweet and syrupy one. I'm the one that wants to call them up to be sturdy. And that means I have to be tough. So if you're wondering which kind, I'm sorry if it offends you, but I'm more on the tough side. Pollyanna and Heidi, those are sweet stories in which the disability really was just a figment of their imagination. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about, you know, pushing some self-esteem smoke into the kid and saying it's all going to be just fine. These are real disabilities. These are real challenges. How many of you have seen a rise in our culture in which parents are well informed of the idea of disability, and they will come to you as a school and say, my child has this diagnosis. I know because I found it in my research on the internet. My child has this diagnosis, and they need this accommodation and this accommodation and this accommodation. They simply can't do these things. How is your school going to accommodate my child? Have you ever had, how many of you have ever had that conversation? It's a fun one. So we'll talk about that. So this is not catering to a child-centered and customer service-oriented culture. The culture in which we live is consumeristic. We believe that our identity is what we buy or can buy. That is not healthy, and that's not biblical. So there are a couple of things that I'd like to show you in the way that it works for our school. I'm going to give you some details so that hopefully, Lord willing, the video that I had made so that you could see inclusion in action, you will understand it. So defining so the support levels that we have at our school. I am not saying that these are support levels that every school should have. I'm saying this is what's worked for us. No, they're not there, but they will be on the screen. We have level one, check in and check out. This is particularly for students with executive functioning disorder. Raise your hand if you don't know what that means. Okay? So executive functioning is the ability, the place in your brain where your brain says, I am in charge of what's happening in the rest of your brain. You are going to attend now. You are going to be organized. You are going to get these papers in this pocket, and you are going to take these books to this class, and you are going to make it through, and when you're finished, you are going to remember it. That's executive functioning in a simplistic mindset, and there are students who struggle with that. I personally believe that the majority of the reason the kids struggle with it is because they're not given chores at an early age, so they don't know how to execute because they've never been asked to do anything but go to a class or go to gymnastics or play on their iPad. But nonetheless, it doesn't matter why it's that way. It is, and it interrupts what's happening in our classrooms. And so I want to help families who, particularly kids who need that, if we think that it's a family that needs to be supported. So check in and check out is level one. So level two is check in, check out, meaning check in at the beginning of the day, tell them what they need to do and what they need to have, and then check out at the end of the day. Basically, the kid's on their own through the rest of the day for level one. But check out and, level two, we also add to that check on. So we might need to just make sure that they made it to that actual class. Because sometimes, particularly in the upper school, that gets to be a little bit tricky for them. Level three would be when we begin to modify and individualize instruction for part of the day, not all of the day. So it might be a couple classes. It might be a particular area of need. And then level four, which is a new level that we've added this year, is when we modify and individualize for the full day. We actually believe that they need a one-on-one assistant or somebody working with them in a specialized way all day long. And in case you're wondering, all of this has to be at an added expense because it's an added expense to the school. Do I think that the parents are always able to pay that full expense? That's a philosophy decision for your school. For us, we have a fee structure that helps to pay part of the expenses, but it can never pay all of them, and so it becomes a fundraising opportunity for me. By the way, people are very motivated to give to student support programs. There are millionaires in your community, truly, and they're very happy to give, and all you have to do is develop relationships with them and be an advocate for your students. How many of you are willing to be an advocate for students with disabilities? Yeah, that's most teachers, right? And so get on out there. So these are our support level structures, the fee structure. As I said, this does not by any means cover all of the costs, but it is part of it, and it's helping the parents to understand, because I think this is a very severe problem in our movement. There are people who come to our school who think that coming to this wonderful little community of classical Christian educators, where the classrooms are orderly, where their child is fully known and fully loved, where the teaching is to mastery and the instruction is systematic, where the child's soul is fed as their body is trained, where the parents believe that that alone is going to help their kid. And you have to help them understand that that alone, everything they've just described, is for a class of average students in a classical Christian school. The tuition payment for the year is not average students and students with disabilities. Unfortunately, students with disabilities have extra needs and an extra cost that everyone cannot bear. And so we have to walk alongside them and say, you're going to need to be a part of this. And yes, we will also work alongside of you and try to get funding for that. And so far, God has blessed us with the ability to carry on that program. But what I found is parents will come and say, that's the reason we're paying tuition. We knew our kid had these problems. Oh, that might have been helpful for you to disclose that in the family interview. We knew our kid had these problems, and we are expecting you to do that. That's why we chose the school. Okay, well, what this school is about is not a special education school, although we have the capacity to provide support. So I think sometimes defining those terms is really critical. How many of you have had those difficult conversations? Yeah, okay. So these are our fee structures. Now here, I will try to get to the video. Hopefully all is well. I'm just giving you an opportunity to see what it looks like on our campus. It's just a 2-minute video. So you can see the support levels. You can see what it looks like. It may end up giving you more questions than answers, and hopefully technologically it'll all work. Well, it's working on my computer. Annie M. Well, what you might do is write down that link. But the 20-something is going to solve the problem. Okay, well, in the meantime, as Vanna is working, I'll explain a little bit about our structure. So, there are, in our school, I have a director of student support, and I have, you're so awesome, and I have some assistants and a teacher who, when it's available in her schedule, she provides support for students. So you'll see the teacher and you'll see the assistants. What you won't see is the director, because that's often the way it is. The person who's behind the scenes making it happen is not the one that you often see. So let's try again. Thank you, Lydia. can move on. Alrighty. So, I hope that's helpful, but let me explain a few things that you saw. By the way, if you want to see that video again, copy down that link, because it's Vimeo, and you can find it there. That may or may not be helpful. Not so sure, but hopefully. I figure if a picture is worth 1,000 words, then a video must be worth 1,000,000. So, I'll leave that up there for a second so that you can copy that down if you need to share that with someone. Now, a couple of things that you saw. You saw a young girl who was born with CHARGE syndrome, which affects so many parts of her development. It affects her cognitively. It affects her visually. She's profoundly hearing impaired. She had significant impairment of her heart. And she is one of three precious covenantal children. Which one would you say Caesar should educate? And the family was really challenged because for them, they want their children all at one school. And was it possible that this child could actually be at our school? And what they're seeing is that she is thriving and that God has provided. So a donor approached me when they knew that the family was struggling and that one of their issues was paying for the assistant. Although the family wanted to pay their part, they also knew that their part was not all. And a donor approached me and said, I'd like to make sure that this student has what she needs for as long as she needs it. That happens when you have students with disabilities because people care, because God cares. God cares. He will not abandon his children. What you also saw was a young woman who is in our upper school this year. She's in our seventh grade. She was adopted. She was adopted through the state, through CPS, meaning that she had to be removed from her home and was adopted in foster care. And from the foster care, she was adopted by a family. And when she was in first grade, her parents came to us, and they have two daughters from the same birth mom, different fathers. And the one that you saw in the video, you wouldn't know which one she is, but one, we, as far as we can tell, since the mom has no understanding of what happened in pregnancy, as far as we can tell, the young girl is permanently affected by fetal alcohol syndrome. And so that is a cognitive impairment that has affected her in every way. It has affected her understanding of language. And she has been in a language-rich environment, and she struggles and needs to have modified instruction in order to get her even close to her grade level. She is adamant that she wants to graduate with a Texas high school diploma. It's going to mean she has a lot of work to do. I don't know if she can do it, but I'm willing to support her, especially since she's pushing herself. You also saw a number of students with dyslexia. That is not our dyslexia hut. It's our garden center, our nature center. It happens to be an extra space where our kids who have dyslexia, when their parents have said, we think that they need to have tutored, they need to be tutored so that they can get up to grade level, then we allow that intervention to take place in lieu of the normal language arts instruction that they would receive. What we found is that with a competent and skilled instructor, they've made 1 year's progress in their reading levels in 6 months' time. So it may only be another year or two before they're able to truly be mainstreamed and graduate from needing intervention. So we're excited about that. Some kids with dyslexia actually don't need to have specialized instruction. They just need more consistency and maybe some after-school tutoring. And what we're figuring out is how to make that work. What we don't want to say is, I'm sorry, your kid has dyslexia. They have to go. You also saw a young girl who, as far as we can tell, has dyscalculia, which is a new word. And it is similar to dyslexia, only in math. She struggles with visual perception. She struggles to understand what's going on around her. You wouldn't know that because she's very capable and very lovely. And you can watch her perform and dance and you think she's completely aware of her surroundings. But she has no concept of time. Because even though she's had a clock in the room and people are talking about time in the ways that children normally do with their parents, none of that has filtered through. So we figured out a way to get her interested in understanding it. We took her through stories and had her follow through the story with a clock and a Judy clock and graphic organizers to help her understand time. And here's a girl who is in third grade and has no concept of the clock, even though it's been presented. And so this year, in a matter of a few weeks, she's mastered a lot of those skills that she was never able to have. We blew it up. We attached it to things that we thought that would work with her, and that she's been successful in that. So we have a couple of these things that have been successful for us and different ways that we've found ways in and connecting the curriculum that are up here on the table if you want to talk about them and look at them afterwards. Student support is an opportunity for virtue formation for your school. What I don't mean by that is that students with disabilities are somehow more virtuous than students who don't have disabilities. That would be a very false and unbiblical way of looking at them. What I can say is that the struggle that they have is the struggle that many of our schools need in order to understand their school better. So if you are a special ed teacher and you have ever been in the privileged situation of being in a typical classroom and supporting students with disabilities, how many of you have been inclusion teachers, maybe in the public school? Or how many of you as special ed teachers have co-taught with other people and have seen, oh, well, actually the reason that's not working for your special ed student is because it's actually not working for most of them. They just aren't going to tell you. And that is why special ed is so special, because we're able to see what's not working for anyone. And that's why you need kids with disabilities in your school, because they are going to be the symptom that causes you to become more strategic and more systematic in your structure as a school. That's very helpful. So for us this year, I've moved the person who is directing the student support program to also be my director of curriculum and instruction, because so often, in the midst of supporting kids with disabilities, we see holes in what's happening in our classrooms, and we need to be not only the person who sees the hole, but the person who fixes the hole, because that's what helps our schools get better. The other thing that students with disabilities will expose is the hearts of our other students. We will see that our students are struggling with self-centeredness because they are unwilling to talk with a student who's socially awkward. We will see that they're unwilling to play with them because it's extra work. We will see that they're unwilling to be gracious and humble with a student who struggles with reading. And that exposes their heart. And that is good for us. They will see that students with disabilities are worth the extra work and the extra resources. They will see that students with disabilities have teenagers who are assigned the privilege of helping to modify their material. And some of those teenagers, they may not know that they're assigned, and I hope that they don't. Some of those teenagers have been assigned the privilege of checking on them at recess so that a cool kid approaches a student with disability at just the right moment. Because students who have areas of need provide an opportunity for the body of Christ to respond. And that is an opportunity for virtue formation. And did you notice in the video there were some teenage young ladies who were helping to modify some of the materials? And in fact, some of those materials are right up there so you can see. It all just happened the same week that we were taking the video. Kind of works out that way. So some strategies and principles for student support. It needs to be curriculum-based instruction. And when I say that, I mean your curriculum, not somebody else's curriculum. So you have to look at each individual student and determine what their needs are. And guess who has to determine what their needs are? You, not their parents. Now, their parents need to have a seat at the table. They need to be part of the process because they have information you don't have. But this is not a macchiato. It is not whether you want skim or soy or almond milk. This is about your curriculum, and you are the experts of that curriculum. And when you see that a child can't, the solution is not, let's just take that off the table. The solution is, how do we get them to the point where they can? And typically, it's how do you become more systematic in what you're doing? And how do you get to the root? How do you figure out what they're not doing? And so in that long section on there on the outline, I have some ways that make it difficult for the information to get in. And you should just begin asking questions. Questions followed by questions followed by questions. So when you're looking at the issues of modifications, there are times when you say, we are going to take this off the table. We're taking it off the table this year. And we're putting it back on the table as soon as we can. How many of you have a scope and sequence in your language arts curriculum that you follow and you know, when do you teach two paragraph essay, when do you teach five sentences, whatever it is? So our student who is in our seventh grade, from a language arts perspective, is several years behind. So we figured out that on a skill base, she's at a second grade level in her language arts ability to write. So there are aspects in which she is part of her class, and the class is reading Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and we have that there, a version that we gave to her because she needs a lot of pictures and she needs to really simplify it so you can find anything on the internet. And so we did. A lot of copy and pasting, made her a book so that the class is talking about Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. She opens up, I know what we're talking about. The class is having a discussion. She has a question that's been prepared. The student support person has told her teacher, this is the question that Dee Dee's ready to answer today. The teacher is doing all kinds of great Socratic discussion and then asks Dee Dee the question that the teacher said she's ready to answer. Dee Dee gets to answer. That's practicing a skill that Dee Dee needs at that point in her life. The class is assigned several pages of an essay on Sir Gawain. Dee Dee is still at the scope and sequence of a second grader. She is writing a three-paragraph essay. And there we have it. So we've differentiated that task in a way that is helpful for Dee Dee and in a way that does not detract from the class. And by the way, Dee Dee really doesn't need that much support in the classroom. She behaves very well. She just needs somebody to be the mother bird to go out and get that material and bring it back in a way that's palatable for the little birdie. So, one thing for you to understand is that when we are dealing with students with disabilities, students who have peers who have been interacting with them their whole life are going to be best prepared for life as an adult. And that is also the same for students without disabilities. The church has disabilities. And so many of our church programs are focused on segregating and having them out into another place so that they're contained. But the problem is, they're part of the body. And they always will be. And when they're an adult at age 30, there isn't a program for them. And they need to be learning how to worship. They need to be learning how to be equipped as a part of the body. And guess what? They're a functional part of the body. This young girl that I've described who's in seventh grade, whose language arts abilities are well below her age level, is a very hard worker. And when we are doing service projects, she can outperform any of her peers. And when something needs to be called wrong, she's the one who's going to do it. Oh, that's not right. Her class needs her more than she needs them so often. So as I mentioned, they have to the modifications that we make and the support that we give has to be done in a way that does not compromise either. It cannot be all about Dee Dee in her seventh grade classroom. It has to be about the seventh grade classroom. Dee Dee's one in that class. So peer support is very helpful. You can teach students how to interact with students with disabilities in a way that is very functional and productive and helps prepare the future church. Teacher support. As I mentioned, just training a teacher in the differentiation of a skill. This is how this student is going to do that thing that you're having the entire class do. Everyone else is working on math facts. Well, this student can't work on math facts in that way. They're going to work on it in a different way. Instead of writing it with a pencil, they're going to be doing it with flashcards because that's where they are. Instead of doing it with the pencil or with flashcards, they're going to be filling in a number at a certain place because that's where they are. So you take the skill and you say, how does this kid do this? What you never, never, never do is say, how do I fill up the time? How do I keep this kid busy? Because it's math class, and they're not very good at math. So I should keep them busy with math toys that will help them pass the time. That is not inclusion. That's what you do in church. No, actually, you don't even do that in church. Don't say. So you teach them how to differentiate on their level as much as they can, but the most important thing for you to understand is that teacher is the teacher of the class. The parents at your school are partnering with you for 1 year, for a year of instruction in that class. The student with a disability has a bona fide disability, and it must be addressed, and you can't just put that on the teacher. That's what the public schools are doing, and they're killing education because of it. They're saying, oh, well, the regular classroom teachers should be able to do this. I mean, come on, how hard is it? They've only got 28 kids. They need to also be trained in intervention and relational difficulties. Kids with disabilities don't get other people very well. It's part of the nature of their disability. The ability to understand unwritten rules of communication, the unwritten rules of our language, is a skill that's part of a language delay that many kids with disabilities are lacking. And so in order for them to be successful, they need somebody to be very black and white and very clear. But teachers need to know, this is how I interact with this student. It's very critical that they understand that relational difficulties with their peers are normal and are going to happen, and an opportunity for us to shepherd hearts. They're still responsible, though, in as much as I'm saying don't put it all on the grammar school teacher or the classroom teacher, they're still responsible for that student. You don't want them thinking, oh, thank God, I've got a student with student support. That's one less kid for me to worry about. No, they're just as much a part of your class as everyone else. It's just that when it gets past the part of what everyone else is doing, we've got someone to come in and help support that student. And there's a director who you can ask questions of, who can guide you and provide resources for you. So I've talked about peer support, I've talked about teacher support, and now I want to talk about administrative support. Inclusion is not something that teachers should be carrying the burden of on their own. The administration should be behind it. Now, if you're an administrator, you might be thinking, this is a nightmare. I don't know how I could possibly get the funding. I don't know how I can manage all that. And I would ask you to not look at this as a program, but as a person. Every single student in your school is a person, and they're part of a family. And one of the terrible tragedies of what's happening within our movement is that so many of these families feel forced out of our classical Christian communities because their kids who have a disability aren't able to have their educational needs met at your school. And I would say, by and large, the idea that their educational needs aren't being met is a myth. I would say that you're probably just as capable as I am. And so I would encourage you as administrators to get behind this. If you want your school to grow, grow as a community by keeping all of your families there. So I would also say this to you. You are not lowering your standards by allowing exceptions. Exceptions don't define your program. If you have a student with a disability and you have a committee of experts on that kid and people who are invested in your school who have said it is not in this child's best interest for them to have the same standard of writing as everyone else in this class, but by golly, they will do all that they can when they can, that does not mean that you're lowering your standard. That's an exception. And exceptions don't nullify the standard. They don't define it. They are an exception. So the idea that all the other kids in the class would graduate with this diploma and this child would graduate with a modified diploma really is okay. It really is. I would also ask that as administrators, you treat students with disabilities similarly to other students. Please do not consider them your little pets. Please don't consider them as cute. Please don't treat them in that way. I once knew of an administrator who shared with me, oh, well, I know exactly who I want to work with this student. There's this really grandmotherly person, and she's so cute, and she holds so-and-so's hand as they walk in the hall. And I'm thinking, that is the last thing that kid needs. She is not your pet. She is not your doll. She is a young woman in training. And prepare her. They don't need grandmotherly people to hold their hands and dote on them. They need people who are going to push them and who are going to see them as future adults. And what are they doing today that is helping them to become that? You say that about all your other students. How are you training the affections of your kids if you are teaching them that they're perpetual children? That's not what Scripture calls us to do. So you want to avoid the special student stigma. You want to avoid making it as if these students, they're over here. Now, do you work one-on-one with them? Yes. Now, our school is blessed. We are blessed beyond measure. We have a courtyard in the center of our school, and even in our worst wintry days, it's really not terrible, and we can be out in the courtyard if we're having one-on-one instruction. Or we might use a common gathering space in our lunchroom, in our Patriot Hall, which you saw with Elle at the end when she see her little hearing aids, and you can see her assistant working with her one-on-one. Well, in a few hours, that room's going to have children all around. We're using a common space rather than we've got to go to the special ed place over here. That might be helpful for you, but you also have a library. So by being in a common space, you're saying, this kid who needs specialized instruction, they're just like everybody else. They just need some one-on-one time. And I'll bet you that you have students in your school who need one-on-one time from now and then. Maybe there was a particular lesson in pre-calculus that they didn't get, and they need some one-on-one instruction. Well, that's what we're doing for our kids with special needs. Oh, I also said on there, sorry, support families staying together in your school. Personally, if there is a family that is a committed member of our community, and how many of you have families in your school that you say, wow, they get it, they are there, they are all in. And then you have families where you think, well, they're mostly all in. And then you have families where you think, I don't think they're hurting us. And then there are some families that just don't make it in your school, thank God, right? Because you know that they're actually not going to contribute. They're going to pull away resources more than they're going to contribute. The families in your school who receive student support should be these families. If you try to have a family here that's at this level, I'm intentionally not saying anything that would get me in trouble since this is recorded. That's why I'm using hand motions. If you have a family that's here and they need student support, they're going to pull away from your resources. The families who are here and need student support should be getting it because you don't want to lose them. They're going to be with you for a long time. And I will fight to keep those families. And that makes a difference in how they're going to educate their children, does it not? You've seen these families and how they carry out their daily tasks with their children when they're picking them up, when they're dropping them off. And it makes a difference as to how they're going to turn out as adults, right? Okay. So here's the reality about disability. It's hard. And it doesn't go away. It's not Pollyanna, it's not Heidi, you can't throw that wheelchair off the side of the cliff. It's hard. Do you know what the statistics are for families with disabilities regarding divorce? Well, in the 90s, it was over 90%. And I don't think it's gotten any better. I'm confident it's worse. Families today are struggling, and those are families without children who have disabilities. It's a strain on the entire family. And it's important for you to help them, to come alongside of them. There are ways in which they will be enabling, or there are ways in which they are equipping their children. And it's up to you to find the trust in your relationship so that you can help them to see that they're enabling their child. You have to be brave enough to say, I love you, I care about you, I want the best for you. I've got to tell you, this accommodation that you're asking for is not in their best interest. We want your child to be eloquent and strong in the way that God has made them. And if you keep pulling off all the things that are difficult, you are going to wind up with a very fragile child. That is not our goal. Our goal for your child is that they would be sturdy. You've got to be willing to say that. If you've got a family that has a disability in their midst, the entire family is struggling. And it is such a gift to have someone who cares and someone who's on their side. But I guarantee you, everyone is struggling. The siblings are taking on a heavy load. And there are times you have to say, I love you and I care about you. You've got to pay attention to the siblings here because they're feeling the load and they're not seeing that you are as intentional about the time that you spend with them as you are with your child who has a disability. Let's not let that define you. And as I'm alluding to, the issue is really having a Christ-centered home versus a child-centered home. We all struggle with that. And as parents, it's important for us to constantly put our eyes on Christ. Christ has made you in his image, and you are broken, and I am broken, and you have a disability, and I don't. Let's not cave and say, oh, we're all disabled. Actually, some of you aren't. It really takes away from the truth of how hard it is to have a disability if everyone says, oh, we're all disabled. I have a hearing disability. I guarantee you it's a lot harder for me to make it through a day than it is for you. So don't take away that. The reality is that what they're living with is very hard. But we can't let that define us, and we can't let that define their family. We owe it to them to help them to have a Christ-centered home. What has Christ called you to in the midst of your challenges? Yes, I understand. It is more challenging for you to pay attention right now. I understand it's more challenging for you to be a part of what's going on. And yet, I still expect it of you, because God has called you to something better. I'd like to give you an opportunity to ask questions. We have 6 minutes left. And I'd like to give you an opportunity to take a look at what's up front. And I'd like to ask that you're patient with me, because I really am hearing impaired. So please, ask away. Yell from the back. Right, right. So you hold all the cards. That's the rule. Everything has to be under the school's control. And so in our parent-student handbook, which you could find on our website, I'm not saying our parent-student handbook is the model of all, but there are some stipulations in there that say, if there is a disability, it's going to be determined by the school. And yes, you may find an OT or a pediatrician that will tell you everything you pay them to say. But that doesn't mean that we are going to agree with them. So the disability has to be defined by us. We have to say, there's a problem. Here's what we're seeing. And then we will assemble a committee, which we call an ARD committee, just like the public school. I think it's the one thing they got right, is that whole process, is the IEP process. So we have that, but we don't follow the way in which they handle it. The parents actually have a seat at the table. So to answer your question, it's all about what we think. Because yes, they will come to me and they will say, well, my child has this disability, and we went to this OT and they said that they should be on a yoga ball during class. Thank you so much for sharing. Not happening. What other questions? There, I saw one. Yes? Yeah, so we have to put that in our general communication always, right? So there's the whole school is hearing that, and Keith McCurdy, who I keep plugging. I really don't have a cut from all the plugging that I do for him, but Keith McCurdy is a great person to have at your school, because he will help he will give your parents the language in which they will say, you're right, I don't want to have a fragile child, I want a sturdy child. And on that, you have this framework and common language on which we can all agree, we don't want fragile children. Let's remember what will happen if we have fragile children. Let's remember this. Let's remember that. And essentially, Melody, it's all about trust and earning that right to be heard. And that takes time. And by the way, if you are in the process of helping a family understand that they have a disability, please understand it takes persistence and it takes time. Sometimes it takes 6 months for them to agree with you, and sometimes they're mad at you. You've got to deal with that. So what other questions? Yes, I'll get to you next, okay? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes. These are the parents that become adversarial. Right. Well, I appreciate your thoughts. I would love to be part of a mission that is all about saving families, being super nanny and going in and telling them how to get it. But that's actually not the mission that I was hired to do. I was hired to partner with families who want a classical Christian education. And I have to tell myself that, because I have this redeemer complex, which is idolatry and sin on my part, and just that special ed teacher in me that just wants to go out and save them. And I have to say, that's actually not my job. My job is to speak the truth in love. And so what I would say to families, if I've been telling them for a long time, you have to earn the right. I want them, I have to say we can't provide, we can't help you anymore, I want them to be looking back at their time at our school and say, but they did everything they could. I would rather them look back and say they did everything they could, and they loved us well, rather than they just wanted us gone. So there are some kids that we've provided support for families who were here, because we thought that would help. And that was a mistake on our part. And we're learning from that mistake. And so this was the year that we had to say, we can't, and it was painful. You had a question on the aisle there. Oh, actually, no, I'm sorry. Yes, sorry, you were on the aisle too. Well, and sometimes you can send them to somebody who's an expert, and maybe they don't have a diagnosis, but at the end of the day, it comes down to what do you as a school think needs to happen? At the end of the day, you still hold all the cards and all the responsibilities. So our levels are really not based on a diagnosis. Our levels are based on the team's decision that we think this child needs this, this, or this. We're not waiting for a diagnosis. We might say they struggle with this. One thing I didn't say that I should say is we have a speech and language pathologist who is part of our school family. And I have a situation with her in which she sees clients on our campus. They're students of ours. She sees those clients on our campus. And her rent for seeing her clients on our campus that we have referred, we refer clients to her because she's a Christian who's a speech therapist and she's really good. Her rent is offering me some services. So sometimes what my go-to response will be, unless I think it's something else, my go-to response will be, let's get a speech and language evaluation because there's a lot that you can see in a speech and language evaluation. How many of you have a friend who's a speech therapist? Are they a Christian? Well, get them in your school. So it's a great go-to response. It's a great way to be able to say, okay, well, we know that they're so-and-so delayed in language. So, okay, well, it is officially past our time. It has been a blessing to see you all here. Thank you for all that you do. God bless you.